Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Welcome to The Roy Green Show podcast.
We have faith in CRA, which is an independent agency, to collect the money that is owed. I don't know about you, but having an argument with CRA about not wanting to pay your taxes is not a position I want anyone to be in. Good luck with that, Premier Mo.
I'll just say this before we talk to the Premier, and that is the Prime Minister should have learned in 9 years, or maybe a daddy's knee, that you really shouldn't use a federal agency to threaten someone, anyone. Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe joins us. Premier, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing well, Roy. Hello to you and all your listeners on what is a beautiful day in the prairies.
Yeah, it's. I hear it's beautiful out there. You just told us, but I heard this morning when I was on the air with our Alberta stations. So here we have the Prime Minister of the country, and maybe I just misunderstood, but we have the Prime Minister of the country using the CRA, tell me if I'm wrong, as a threat lever against you. Is that how you interpreted it?
Well, it sounds like you think you might be experiencing this differently, Roy. But we submitted our taxes in Saskatchewan. We had a unanimous vote in the legislature where we made a decision to mirror essentially a decision that the federal government did around their tax policy in Atlantic Canada. And so we've submitted all of our taxes. And so I think the CRA is going to find, just come to that conclusion that Saskatchewan has submitted all of the taxes that they're required to submit. That's our view. CRA may have a look into that. But and if they don't find that, I guess there'll be a discussion to be had. And CRA, yes, is there to likely ensure that Canadians and businesses have paid all of their taxes. We'll see how they make out if they feel that they need to come after a province or a provincially owned crown corporation, I suppose. But, you know, at the end of the day, what we've done in Saskatchewan is by unanimous consent and vote of the Legislative Assembly, all parties, independent members voted to mirror the federal government and to remove the carbon tax from the heating oils that we are using here. As opposed to just those that may be used predominantly in Atlantic Canada.
So you are not collecting, though, carbon tax on heating oil, correct?
Not on heating oil, not on natural gas, not on electricity. We would further, our original ask was for the federal government to extend that exemption to all types of heating oil, because there's still propane and some other heating sources that are out there that, unfortunately, they're still paying the carbon tax. And so this is a very unfair decision that the federal government made. It's a carve out, and they just simply are not being fair to all Canadian families. And so we stepped in, mirrored it, and to the degree that we are able, are being fair to at least Saskatchewan families.
Okay. I don't want you and I to leave this interview experiencing things differently. So, could I just go back?
Well, thankfully, the budget is going to balance itself soon. So,
oh my goodness,
we would experience that the same.
There's so many lines, Premier. Let me just be absolutely serious for a moment here. Did you hear in what the Prime Minister said? Did you hear him use the federal agency, Canada Revenue Agency, to threaten you?
Well, he thinks he's going to, or he thinks they're in some way threatening us. But as I said, it's our position that we've paid all of the tax that is owing, and so the threat is not a threat at all, because we are paid and we're paid in full here. That's Saskatchewan's position, and so we may have a difference of position. Our position is we've paid in full enough. The Prime Minister thinks he's going to start sending agencies after provinces that have had unanimous votes in their legislation to pass legislation. Provinces are not subservient governments to the federal government. We have areas of jurisdiction, and we intend on using it. And so, you know, he may have his views. I believe he's wrong with those views. And he may think that he's going to use, you know, federal agencies at his discretion to, you know, frighten provinces or frighten, you know, entities into acquiescing to his views. And that's just simply not the case. Yeah.
He tried to use the courts to intimidate Admiral Norman, suggesting twice that Admiral Norman would probably see, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, see the inside of a prison sentence or prison cell. And then when the case appeared before the prosecutor, the case that wasn't a case, the prosecutor just ran for the towel to throw it in. And that was the end of that.
Well, right. That might be what we find here as well. As much as he may feel that the CRA would be able to come after, in his case, at his direction, the province of Saskatchewan, if you look into the budget, there's a deep down in the budget in an annex called Annex Number 3. The federal government is actually proposing that they are going to change their Greenhouse Gas Pollution Pricing Act. So that's the Carbon Tax Act. So that they have to change it and change it retroactively so that they can enforce what they think they want to enforce on provincial crown corporation. And so they're wrong in thinking that they can come after Saskatchewan for taxes that they feel Saskatchewan should be paying. And they know they're wrong because they're going to have to change their own legislation retroactively with the budget bill. So we'll be watching for that to come through as well. And that, again, I think speaks to just the disappointing situation that we are in nationally here.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned the Admiral Norman's situation and story only because the environment minister federally had suggested, if I remember correctly, it wasn't that long ago, that breaking federal law, which he anticipates you're doing, could result in prison time. I mean, you've got it coming at you from every direction now.
Yeah, there is... I noticed that way back when Catherine McKenna was actually the environment minister and some of her folks were putting together the original act. They had put much of it under criminal, the criminal code, essentially, which is disturbing in this nation as well. And so the CRA, I don't think they are going to be able to come after the province of Saskatchewan for mirroring the federal government's decision. By their own admission, the federal government has said as much by saying that the legislation that they currently have has to be changed retroactively in order for that to happen. And so we'll be watching that as the budget bills find their way through. There is another piece to the act that actually is under the criminal code as well, and that's the part that is going to have to be changed. You shouldn't be enforcing laws that you have to take to the Supreme Court of Canada with the Criminal Code of Canada. And much of the additional regulations that you see, clean electricity standards, those types of things, the coal-fired phase-out was similar. They're bringing it in with these Criminal Code of Canada penalties, and that's problematic in a nation like this.
Yeah. You know, Premier, I've always said that if people are angry at you, that's one thing. You can usually manage that. But if people are laughing at you, you've lost.
Yeah, many of the if you just back up and rise up a little bit to when these when the carbon tax was introduced, it was the most efficient way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and it wouldn't require then any other regulations. They very quickly have layered on top of that electricity standards, fuel standards, methane regulations, oil and gas caps, fertilizer caps, electric car mandates on how many electric cars can be sold. Did they forget what they said when they introduced their very first flagship policy, the carbon tax, is that they wouldn't need any of these other regulatory matters if they could only introduce a carbon tax and it would never go above $50. So that's where the people laughing at policymakers comes from, is when you say one thing and you just simply don't do it.
Mm-hmm. Dave in Calgary texts, I heard Mr. Trudeau mimicking an elementary school child, telling someone he'll have his big brother try and beat up Mr. Moe. That's from Dave in Calgary on our text line on 877 399-9898. Premier, moving along here, I saw that Mr. Singh, and I was interested in this, federal NDP leader Jagmeet Singh challenging Mr. Trudeau's, quote, divisive language toward you, divisive language, end quote, toward you in an interview. So Mr. Trudeau's running into at least some challenges from his ally, which is interesting.
Well, I think even Mr. Singh can read the polling and what Canadians are experiencing, which is tremendous inflationary pressure that is brought on by federal policy that Mr. Singh has supported each and every time he's been asked to on the floor of the federal parliament. I mean, he's backed Justin Trudeau on every single vote that of consequence, and pretty much, I think, is committed to for the next 12 to 18 months, which isn't in the best interest of Canadians. And so Mr. Singh is part of the problem. You know, he now that not liking the carbon tax is cool because we're seeing the consequences of that policy, he's now saying, well, you know, maybe we don't like it quite as much as we once did. Well, stand up and vote then against this government and force an election, and let's go to the polls and let's elect a government that Canadians want.
Yeah. Mr. Singh also said earlier this week that he doesn't want an election in 2024, and the polls are telling him why it's not a good idea, as they're telling Mr. Trudeau. Let's just talk about the other premiers for a moment, because Mr. Trudeau always...
Can I just on Mr. Singh not wanting an election?
Sure.
Canadians do. I mean, you should think about that, but that's all I would say is Canadians do. Canadians want a change in government that's going to address... you know, the affordability challenges that all Canadians are experiencing. They're unlike anything I've really seen in my lifetime. And so Mr. Singh should think about that, because he actually is one person that has the ability to allow Canadians an election in the next number of months, as opposed to waiting for 18 months and having our inflationary pressures increase even further. So Mr. Singh has a relevant role to play in this, and we'll see what he does.
Yes, he does. I'll use another word that people are very familiar with when it comes to this minority government and the leader. I don't think Mr. Trudeau has the ethical right to make decisions for Canadians based on where he is in the polling, and repeatedly, again and again and again, his polling numbers show, as you just said, Canadians want an election, and he should really test the waters and see whether or not Canadians will re-elect him. It's fine to run around the country making challenges and accusations, but have the courage to stand up before the electorate.
I also think when you have a minority administration, that it's customary for 4 years of government. You know, we'll be heading to the polls after 4 years this fall. It is really the norm. However, there are allowances to go longer than that, and there's a place for minority governments. I don't know that there is an explanation for a minority government to be going past the 4 year norm that Canadians expect to govern, even a majority government to govern for. And so Mr. Singh, I think, will very much we'll see how he experiences not making the decision to stand up for what Canadians want right now when he finally does pull the trigger and allow Canadians to go to the polls. I would suggest it would be more beneficial for him to do that sooner rather than later, but we'll see where he lands.
Yeah. What about the other premier?
They're working hard at it. Justin Singh and the federal NDP and, Jagmeet Singh, Justin Trudeau, I mixed that up, pardon me. But then they brought in a number of provincial NDP leaders as well to, I think it was the Canadian Labour Congress, brought them all together for a campaign school to re-elect Jagmeet Justin. And so they're working hard on it. I think planning to stretch this out as long as they can, which is not in the best interest of Canadians, and then work together and to try to re-elect Jagmeet and Justin. So very unfortunate.
Yeah, Mr. Ray tried that in Ontario. He stuck around. He had a majority, but he stuck around for 5 years, and he certainly paid a very steep price, his party did, or his erstwhile party did. Let me just ask you about the other premiers.
Yes, let's talk about the other
premiers. Let's talk about the other premiers. They're still demanding a meeting with Mr. Trudeau over the carbon tax, and he's not talking about that. Is there a firm commitment by premiers to continue to push Ottawa on the carbon tax issue your Premier Mo?
I think there's a firm push, not only by premiers, but by premiers that are representing Canadians because of what it's doing. The discussion around the carbon tax not pushing up inflation at the fuel pumps, at the grocery stores, is simply not true. When we made the decision in Saskatchewan to remove the carbon tax from natural gas and electric heating, that's not everyone's heating, and it's just heating. It's not at the gas pumps. It doesn't impact our grocery store prices to a large degree. We're sitting today at half the national CPI rate. I think we're 1.5. The national rate is somewhere around 2.9 or 3. That has been attributed almost entirely to the fact that the provincial government will not collect the carbon tax on how we heat our homes in this province. Can you imagine if the consumer carbon tax was removed from fuel, from all of the costs that our grocery stores, grocery providers are experiencing? The CPI would likely be well in that manageable rate. We wouldn't have the runaway inflation that we have been experiencing. And so policies do matter. And just because you say something about those policies, like a statement like they aren't causing inflation, it doesn't make it true. The fact of the matter is that the consumer carbon tax is greatly pushing up the inflation rates that Canadians are experiencing. That's proven here in Saskatchewan with the decisions we've made, as are the other policies that the government is bringing forward. And premiers are in agreement on much of that.
Premier, I've enjoyed the experience today. Thank you. Thanks for joining us. Good talking.
Take care, and just wishing all your listeners a very good weekend.
Thank you. You as well.
While we respect the judicial process and appreciate the work of everyone involved in this very difficult case, I share the feelings of our members who are hoping for a different outcome.
Let me be crystal clear. I support and accept the verdict of the jury.
Toronto Chief of Police Demke, following the not guilty first-degree murder verdict by the jury last weekend for Umar Zamir, first-degree murder charge in the death of Toronto Police Detective Constable Jeffrey Northrup. And there's been a great deal of response and reaction to that particular statement by the chief. The Canadian Civil Liberties Association now wants to know what steps the Toronto Police Services Board will take to ensure the chief and other police members will not, quote, publicly malign bail decisions or criminal verdicts in the future, end of quote. The Toronto Police Service responded by saying the chief has, quote, stated numerous times that he supports the justice system and accepts the decision by the jury, end quote. Comments made by Ontario Premier Doug Ford, who described the bail issue for Mr. Zamir as, quote, completely unacceptable at the time bail was issued, has also come under review. Mr. Ford has since said his statements were based on limited information on the case. Let's talk to John Reed, the president of the Toronto Police Association. John, thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm good, Roy. Thank you very much for having me today.
Good talking to you, and my sincere condolences, and I'm sure all of our listeners' condolences, on the loss of Detective Constable Jeffrey Northrup.
Well, thank you. We really appreciate your sentiments.
The Toronto Police Association, you had a I checked a tweet that you put out on X, or how do you always get confused with tweet and X, but a statement that you put out on X about the death of Detective Constable Northrup. Can you just share with us what the Police Association's position is and what your thoughts are?
So, you know, as far as the decision of the jury, you know, police officers, we understand that the decision of the jury is the decision of the jury. You know, I think anybody with any particular case, depending on where somebody stands on one side or the other, they may not be happy about the outcome. But you have to respect the outcome. And that's a very, very important piece. You know, we do operate in the rule of law. And that's why we have the judicial system we have. You know, I think it's important to understand that even the case which was brought before the jury, you know, that case had gone through a Crown review. And they have the discretion and their job is to assess to see how their matter is going to proceed. That's one of the key pieces for those individuals.
Yeah, I don't want to spend the whole time that we're talking about the case. I mean, it has the whole country, had the whole country talking, and some of us still have questions, and I'm sure you're among them, but there are other issues I would like to talk to you about. And that is just what it takes to be a police officer, what it is police officers are encountering, and particularly in Canada's largest city, where a number of Toronto police officers have lost their lives in the line of duty, and quite recently. Does this lead to officers questioning how they're deployed, whether they have the necessary resources to take on the job? What's the longer term, I don't want to use the word fallout, but what's the longer term response to the losses of the lives of police officers, John?
So I think when you start looking at what's happened over the last probably two and a half years, we've seen 10 officers killed across Canada. We've lost two police officers here in Toronto, one that was actually murdered, and obviously Jeff Northrup recently, where we had that decision. And I think the general sense amongst membership is policing is getting more dangerous, particularly here in Canada. We haven't seen that many officers killed in the short period of time, and as long as I've been a police officer, which is over 36 years. And to me, it's very concerning. I'm seeing a rise in assaults. We had one assault on a police officer, on a uniformed police officer, on the street when an individual came up and punched the police officer for no reason at all. And then we had another police officer involved in an arrest with a broken leg. And then we had the other officer recently that was stabbed during an arrest. And once again, it's incredibly frustrating for me when I see this happening, because I've seen the decline in kind of the respect on the street for police officers. And I think it really does strike a note with me and our members, but it should also strike a point with the general public as a whole. Because when you start seeing a uniformed police officer and people aren't afraid, to attack a police officer, what does that say about our average citizen? And this is where I really believe we need strong, strong support from our community leaders, municipal. Here in Ontario, we're very fortunate to have a very, very supportive provincial government. But we need to see it at the federal level as well.
So my question was going to be, the next one actually, was, are your members confident when they go out on the streets that they will be supported by senior officers and politicians while those officers are on patrol? What confidence level does the officer on patrol have now, John?
I think that will vary, quite honestly, as to which particular level of government you're speaking about. I know our city council here has not been very supportive. I've been advocating over and over and over to try and get councillors to come out and support the job our police officers have been doing, particularly during the protests that we had recently here in Toronto, ever since October 7th. But it is a larger issue, and I think it's very important to try and get the public's voice, that silent majority, which truly is out there and does support police and does support law and order, to get those people out and get their voices heard as well. Membership-wise, I think internally with the service, the service is there to support our members. I think when something does go sideways, I do worry that the service is a little too quick to make a decision. But ultimately, these investigations have to run their course. And a lot of the times, they end up working out okay.
How often do your officers come back and talk to you about, hey, somebody just stopped me today to say thanks for what you do? Does that happen?
I do, actually. I get the odd call now and then. And to be honest with you, it goes so far with our members, because, as we all see with the media, we end up with such negativity all the time. And, we try and put out all the good news stories, but unfortunately the media seems to hone in on all the negative stories. And those are the ones that can kind of get rebroadcast over and over. And it creates that narrative that there's nothing good coming out of policing, which is exactly the opposite. There is so much good, amazing work done by our members, which is done both on the job during the course of their duties, but also off the job. You know, and I'll just bring you back to Jeff Northrup again. You know, Jeff worked in Brampton, volunteering his time and energy, working with the Northrup family for Special Olympics. And that was very, very important to him. That's just one example of the work that goes on here in Toronto all the time.
Yeah. Let me just bring up a point that nobody in this country is unaware of. And that's what's been going on in the streets of the city of Toronto and in cities across the country. And it's the pro-Palestinian and pro-Hamas demonstrations. And people should remember that Hamas is a defined terrorist organization by the federal government of Canada. Having that said that, do you as a police association feel like your hands are tied here? Let me bring the federal government into this, that your hands are tied at least somewhat in how you may respond to provocation. And you and I have talked about this on this program before. We see American police engage protests, these protests in numbers, and make arrests, not so much in this country. How much of it might have to do with Ottawa not standing behind police officers in Canada?
So I don't think it's so much that Ottawa's not standing behind the police officers. You have to look at the protests that we have here in Canada, in Toronto. And I can tell you the protests have actually changed. The dynamics have changed within those protests recently. And that's why we've seen more arrests. And I think, quite honestly, you know, everyone has to understand that everyone has a constitutional right to be able to protest, but that's protest lawfully and peacefully. And those are the two important points here. And once these protests cross the line into criminality, at that point, police officers have the ability to take action, whether that be an arrest, a caution. But I can tell you here in Toronto, our members have been extremely patient with people through these entire protests. They understand that they are emotionally charged, but that does not mean you're allowed to breach the law. You know, as I think everyone's aware as well, a few weeks back we had individuals throwing horse feces at our officers, individuals trying to spear an officer, another one trying to spear a horse. And the individual that did that to the horse was recently arrested, I think, just last week. So these arrests may come at the time, they may come down the road, but they will be affected.
Okay, final question for you. Are you losing officers to retirement long before they might be expected to take that step because of what officers have been experiencing, particularly over the last few years?
My quick answer to that would be yes. I can tell you, when I first started this policing, you know, 35 years was kind of the mark that everyone would try and get to. I'm seeing more and more now officers going at 28, 27, you know, 30 years. And I think, you know, the reality is policing has lost a lot of this luster over the last four and a half, 5 years. But that shouldn't be the case. It is a noble job. It's a fantastic career. And I would encourage anybody that's interested in policing to have a serious look at it.
Yeah, as we've often said, when the rest of the population runs out because of something that's going on, it's the police officer who runs in to take care of the situation. John, good talking to you. Thank you so much for the time today. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
People in my program started to know I was Jewish. And sometimes, like, I would get questions or, like, stopped in the hallway. It was, like, questions about, like, oh, so you support Israel? I've got friends that were, like, kicked out of parties and out of student clubs for, being a Jewish and being Zionist and really want to, like, hide your Judaism. But it's so, so important that you don't. That any other Jewish student listening, that you don't hide who you are, because that's what their whole goal is.
Emma, 3 weeks ago on this program, Toronto Metropolitan University student, and she's a student of Dr. Eric Kam, who you know very well if you listen to this program with any degree of regularity, macroeconomics professor at TMU, and he really is our go-to person when it comes to economics, both on the national and international level, and how it filters down to all of us. Individually, Dr. Kam is Jewish, and Dr. Kam's advice and support of Emma has made her feel far more secure with who she is and far more secure being at Toronto Metropolitan University as a Jewish student, let me just say this. This is a question, really. Why are university students in both Canada and the United States, as well as in Europe, engaging in Jew hatred? Look, the clinical term is anti-Semitism, but really it's the post-secondary environment that is blatantly Jew hatred, which I never expected to see or experience in any form in this country. Never expected it to happen. Tomorrow we're going to be speaking with a Jewish Canadian who was identified as Jewish at a demonstration that was pro-Hamas and pro-Palestinian. And he was subjected, well, he'll tell us, but he was subjected to vile and intimidating accusations, and he was chased for several blocks before the chase broke off. He'll be joining us. But let's talk to Dr. Eric Kam, our usual go-to macroeconomics professor, and talk to Dr. Kam about what's going on at TMU and at universities in this country. We're also going to play a little bit for you later, some audio from a social media post by a University of Southern California student who will miss her university graduation because it's been canceled due to Jew hatred and an intimidated administration, and she missed out on her high school graduation because of COVID. And clearly and understandably, she's not happy. Eric, what's going on? What's going on at TMU as far as Jewish students are concerned, perhaps even Jewish faculty is concerned? What's going on?
Hi, Roy.
Hi.
What's going on really is that in a lot of ways, there's that silly expression about the greasy wheel getting the oil or whatever it is. And so this is what you've got on my campus, and we're not alone, many campuses, that the loudest group are the anti-Israel, anti-Zionist, anti-Semitic groups. They are large, they are loud, they are proud, and as this drags on in the Middle East, they become more emboldened and they are right in your face. And it's hard not to miss from getting off the subway to making your way to and through the campus. And you asked the question of why. And I actually think there's a conflation of three things going on, none of them good. First of all, it's no secret that universities in North America especially have taken a hold of what we loosely call woke culture or the far left. And right now that far left culture breeds a real hatred of all things Jewish. And how many times do I have to hear from people that we are not a protected group? We are wealthy white people. Let me tell you, I wish my grandparents could have heard that term to describe Jews. Number two, you know, university students have always tried to follow, and you remember this better than me, a bit of a counterculture and be demonstrators and be activists. Well, again, thanks to conflation, that activism is pointed against the Jewish community. I think that's number two. And then number three, sadly, and this makes me almost want to cry, overwhelmingly, faculty are anti-Israel, the faculty that I've spoken to. And of course, what's really awful for me is there is a group on my campus. People can look it up. It's called the Jewish Faculty Network, and it sounds great, but it's composed of some of the most ardent anti-Semites I've ever met in my life. And so again, for students who are following woke culture and following counterculture, a lot of students, me included, looked up to our professors and kind of wanted to be like them and even sound like them. Well, if your professors are preaching anti-Israel, anti-Jewish sentiment, Roy, and you want to sound like those people, you put it all together, you mix it up in a bowl, and you get just a very unsure, unsettled, unstable campus, Roy, for Jewish students.
Yeah. I've been aware of the divestment culture that's existing in universities for some time. But what we've seen over the last 6 to 7 months has really gone over the top, clearly. And it's becoming alarming, or has become alarming, But are you saying to me then that these are disaffected young people who are being led by professors who shouldn't be leading them, and Jewish Canadians are just targets of opportunity, and the war between Israel and Hamas is just the facilitator for what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I would argue in my speaking to students, and as you know, I have an amazing relationship with
you
my
do. Students. I should tell everyone, if you look at the relationship, and it's posted online by students, the relationship that Dr. Kam has with his students is absolutely amazing. They just love him. Carry on, please, Eric.
And he loves them. I mean, I really do. But the problem is that in many of their classes, and frankly, many of their houses, they're getting a very homogeneous message that Israel and Israelis are the aggressors and responsible for this. Largely, they are not being told about or reminded about what happened on October 7th. And so I think that the messages, I mean, remember, they're young people, Roy. These are 18-year-old people, and they get the messages from the people that they respect. And I'm afraid right now that universities are just a microcosm of society that have decided that their sympathies are not with the Israeli people. I think a lot of people have forgotten what stimulated this attack on the 7th. And I say that, by the way, from a place of knowledge. So as I mentioned, that Jewish Faculty Network had a meeting this week. And a lot of my friends thought I was crazy. And that's a separate issue. But I went. I attended. It was virtual, but I attended. And I heard people, and I'm not exaggerating, in tears about the Gazans, about the Palestinians, about the what they are facing thanks to Israel. And never once in the 1 hour that I was present did I hear anything about the 7th of October. I never heard about the bombing or the raping. I never heard anything about hostages being taken and not returned yet. I mean, there's just a singular message out there on my campus and, again, other campuses that this is, and I heard a student say this to me, is that they're having to contend with the Israeli problem and the Zionist problem. And it really struck me, Roy, and I'll tell you why, because that sounds a lot like the Jewish problem from 1933. And so I think that the message they're getting on campus from the people that they are supposed to be respecting is so negative that they just, that's all they've got. If you only hear one message, it's all you have. And I think it starts to get pervasive, and it leaves Jewish students, frankly, that you probably saw in the newspaper that a young lady is suing the campus for $1.3 million.
Yes.
Because she said she's afraid and she's alone. You know what? That's how many of the Jewish students and faculty feel today, Roy, scared and alone.
On Twitter, there's this from McGill University, and it's 17 minutes old. McGill has begun an encampment to demand university divest from companies and initiatives tied to the genocidal state. In the largest referendum in McGill history, students recently voted 80% to divest, but administration has ignored them. Now they're taking space until the administration concedes. That's where the police should arrive. Here's another one. It's 12 minutes old from Montreal, and it says, all the CAFE are wearing Concordia and McGill, can't read the next word, camping out, chanting in hopes of the annihilation of Jews and Israel. We had a huge heads up from the chaos at Columbia University, so why no police? It's almost as if the schools and government want this to happen. Word I couldn't read was zombies. So, Eric, when you hear that about McGill University and, you know, it's going on, how do you react to that?
Well,
I mean, it's almost a redundant question, isn't it? I'm sorry. I apologize.
No, it's not a redundant question at all, Roy. It's heartbreaking. This is supposed to be, and McGill is supposed to be, you know, one of the top three or five universities in the country. And you see what's coming out of it. And it's actually heartbreaking. And so to go back to your previous question, who supports the Jewish students?
Who's standing with the Jewish students? You are, and you're Jewish, but they've come to you and they gain strength from you.
Yeah, and I appreciate that, but I'm just one person, and there's lots of me, by the way. There are lots of Jewish faculty that are there to support their students. The problem is that I see there is that Jewish profs are a tiny minority on the campus, and sadly, a sizable group of that tiny minority, Roy, are not friendly to Israel. I tell the famous story about a professor I know. I obviously won't give their name. That at one time on their office door had a Jewish star with a line through it. And what's that? What message is that going to send to the students? And so, you know, there are in Canada, we have places called Chabad House, but it, unfortunately, TMU doesn't have one. We have Hillel, which is a Jewish student group, and they do the best job that they can. But yes, to your point, and then another thing I should add is that in the message being circulated, it's pretty funny how Jewish people are in so many people's narrative, not indigenous to the land. I mean, we know you can go back to the Old Testament, if you like the Bible, and you see that Jews are indigenous to that part of the Middle East. But the story that they're told, so many of our students from so many of our faculty, you know, starts way after that. And the narrative begins with the Jews stole the land from the native Middle Eastern people. And that's just frankly not true. And then people jump on that. I mean, the history of Jewish people being kicked out of various parts of the Middle East over the last 3,000 years is well told. So it's a tough time, right? We can't and we shouldn't candy coat it. Jewish students, if they feel scared, should reach out to people that they feel are safe spaces. I'm always around. And I can recommend other faculty that are supportive. We, quite frankly, have our own meetings. Again, we're not large, but we're caring. And what we just try to tell Jewish students is that it should not be wrong or dangerous or scary to be Jewish and go to university. But unfortunately, they're looking back at us and saying, but sir, right now it is. So unfortunately, we're between a rock and a hard place. All we can do is be out there. I appear on your show. I say it in lecture. If they need me, if they want me to recommend other colleagues, that's really all we can do right now, because the visible message, the audible message they're getting is almost entirely anti-Israel, anti-Zionist. Those are two bad words, Roy, and that's really hard with which to compete.
Yeah, I'm looking, though, my mind's eye sees a couple of 18-year-olds, a couple of 19-year-olds, even a couple of 20-year-olds. One of them is Jewish, the other isn't, but they're both Canadians. They've never been to the Middle East. They have no idea what life is like there. They've just been conditioned to be antagonistic toward one another. And how does that even, maybe it's the human condition, Eric, but it's a lifetime of experience that lets me speak this way. But how do you move forward with such an irrational, unsustainable position? You're not from there. You've never been there. You're dealing with a person who lives in potentially your neighborhood. What are you doing?
You are repeating the loudest message. Back to the first thing I said, when you're the greasy wheel, you get the oil. Well, when the only message that they are hearing loud and clear, sometimes from home, sometimes from their lecture hall, sadly, sometimes both, is that Zionism is a bad word. And then you have a sociology professor at my campus say that they do not want to teach anymore. And I quote, brain dead Zios, unquote. I will leave it there, Roy, because I don't know where to go from there.
Well, I would say even a degree notwithstanding, a PhD notwithstanding, I would doubt whether that individual you just mentioned could spell cat, even if I spotted him the C and the A.
I don't disagree, Roy. I can't begin to tell you what's going on in academia today. I now know a little bit of what, when my grandparents used to say, you know, you're lucky, you don't have to fear being Jewish like we did.
Yeah.
Sadly, I think now we have an idea of what it was like to be scared to be Jewish. And again, when there's one homogeneous message being seen, being heard, being transmitted, Well, you know, you and this goes back to you're about 18 years old.
Right.
When you hear something enough times, you start to believe it, Roy.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.